So we had something big happen earlier this week. Yesterday, in fact. Got a new website.
Woo!
And hope everybody, some of you may have already had the chance to look at it. Some of you may go look at it right now, or may wait till after the show. I do ask everyone is patient with us. There might be a few little kinks here that we have to work out. And if you do see an issue, you send us a message on our Facebook page. And we'll try to get fixed. It was quite a big undertaking, switching over to a new site. Still same web address, completely different look. Should be a lot faster. Cart page and checkout looks a little different.
Yeah, one of the main issues we had back during the springtime was we had a lot of increased traffic, and our website got really slow. And it was slow moving around the pages. It was also slow on your checkout page, and it caused us some issues. We patched as well as we could to get by, but now we hope it's going to be lightning fast.
Yeah.
And the majority of you all look at our webpage on your phone. So things have changed over the last few years. We have to optimize for what we call mobile viewers.
Mm-hmm. So we have a complete, our mobile site looks kind of different than our desktop version. But anyway, go check out the site, look around. The navigation, everything should be pretty much the same as it was, but go check that out. Comment below, tell us how you like it, what you think about it. We're happy, excited about it, and having a new and improved, faster site is going to open a lot of opportunity for us as far as adding that garden planner feature we keep talking about and some other things in the future.
Yep, and nothing drives me crazy than taking up my time being slow. So maybe this will take care of a lot of that. I like fast.
Fast.
Boom, boom.
Boom, boom, boom.
Boom, boom.
What's going on? I got corn about honey high.
Honey high.
My prime sweet corn.
I didn't grow any fall corn.
Sally whooped mine pretty hard early because it wasn't that tall, just germinate. But mine's coming around, boy. It's green. It's greener than your shirt is. And it's like I said, this is about honey high. Now, I've been having to spray it at least once a week with spinosad, even though I ain't got any ears. I thought I had them nipped, and then I come back from camping earlier this week and got out there, and I saw a little nibble on some leaves, and you could look down in that plant there, and I saw a few bugs in there. You just, if you're growing fall corn, you can't wait on the ears. I'm convinced you can't wait on the ears to get your spinosad program going. You got to get it going early.
Yeah, I had a lady call from North Florida earlier this week talking about some of her greens or broccoli and things like that was really getting taken over by the worms, and she was using BT, and she wanted to know what to do. So you got to switch it up. You got to rotate those BT and spinosad. It ain't going to hurt, though, your little neem oil in there. But I personally like to spray my neem oil 1 week or one cycle. Sometimes you have to spray it more often than a week. You need to be on a 5-day rotation because the worm pressure is really high right now. So I told her, I said, shorten your intervals up a little bit. Spray with BT 1 week or one cycle, then spray with spinosad. And if you don't, to throw your little neem oil in there on either one of them. You got to go to war with them.
What's interesting about that worm deal, especially on your fall, winter crops, and we'll probably need to do a whole show on fall, winter pest control. I was talking to Jason at Cog Hill about this. Now, I don't really have a whole lot of worm pressure on any of my brassicas. And he was saying he used to, but then once he started, you know, understanding the regimen he needed to be on, he really didn't have that issue. And the worms, to me, they seem like once you get control of them and really control them 1 year, you don't have as much problems in the following
years.
Yeah,
I explained to this lady that exact same thing. You got to break that cycle. And once you break that cycle, it gets a lot easier. Another thing is you got to start before you have a major problem. You can't go out there with an organic pest control product and expect to solve a major problem. Them problems don't happen overnight, and they're not going to get solved overnight. You got to be proactive.
Yep. If you had a problem last year, you can bet your bottom dollar you're going to have a problem this year, and it's best to be proactive about it.
Proactive. That's what I was looking for.
Proactive. Yeah. Speaking of corn, going back to that real quick, as I was out there peering at my corn plot, it's just a little bitty patch, four rows there, about 20 foot long. As I was studying on it, I got to thinking, you know, there's a lot of YouTube gardeners out there, but there's a huge gap there. There ain't a whole lot of them that grow corn.
Corn's a tough one to grow. A lot of people don't know how to grow corn.
Well, that it got me wondering. Now, I know we grow corn deep south. They grow plenty of corn. My buddy Alan over at the Texas Prepper Channel, he grows a good bit of corn. But, you know, a lot of you big, famous YouTube gardeners, they don't grow corn. And I don't know why. Is it because they can't grow corn? Or some of them are, some of them restrict themselves to be really, really hardcore organic, and it's hard to feed the corn well enough with those methods. It just got me wondering why some of the big, big YouTube gardening channels are not growing sweet corn.
Corn could be intimidating to the average feller.
Maybe they don't like sweet corn like we do down here.
Well, man, I don't know. I love it.
I mean, you can't have a garden, and you gotta ride by a garden down here.
You gotta have corn.
They ain't got a few rows of sweet corn.
That's right.
So I don't know. Maybe they can't grow it. Maybe they don't know how to grow it. Maybe they don't like it. Maybe they just don't have room for it.
Should be our mission to let everybody join in on the success of having sweet corn in their garden.
Yeah. If there's any YouTubers out there would like me to learn them how to grow some sweet corn.
Or teach them how instead of learning how.
Was that give a man an ear of corn, feed him for a day, teach him how to grow it, and feed him for his lifetime.
That's right. Well, fall planting is wide open right now. You told me.
Your stuff in the ground?
Man, I'm working on it. I mean, I'm working on it hard. I got behind a little bit, and I'm trying to play catch up, and it's tough when you get behind.
I went hard one day earlier this week and got a vast majority of my stuff planted, and as I was planting, I realized I didn't have any rutabagas started. I gotta get some rutabagas going. I got a few things I'm missing out on, but I got majority of stuff in the ground. I'm gonna show everybody these pretty puppies right here. I got some of these in the ground, and we got plenty left over. This is broccoli. And show you there what a pretty broccoli transplant looks like right there. Now that don't need to be left in these trays much longer.
Yeah, it needs to be planted.
So I got I planted a whole row of Green Magic, and then I planted half a row of Godzilla, half a row of Emerald Crown. And I did two videos on fall planting. I planted some of my stuff in my traditional plot where I'm doing the drip fertigation, then my no-till plot is where I planted some of this broccoli. I got videos coming on both of those in a few weeks. I'm a little bit ahead on my video schedule because there's been so much going on in the garden and a lot of content being produced. And so the things I did this week won't be airing until a couple more weeks.
Now this tray here is a 162 cell. That means you can put 162 plants in that tray, and these things work perfect. They work wonderful. But don't everybody out there need 162 broccoli plants?
That's right. I didn't need 162.
No. So here's another alternative for you on that. Let me get the switch around this way. This is that product we brought in last year, and this is a 24 cell tray. And this is a heavy reusable. And what I did, because I don't need that many of certain things, if you got raised beds or you got a smaller garden, you may want to go with something like this right here. And what I've got here is I got 12 collard plants and I got 12 dinosaur Alocinado kale plants, which
that's
is enough.
Pretty good, by
it's
way.
Enough for most people that's got a raised bed or a smaller garden. So this here, and another thing about this, these cells are a good bit bigger. So the plants, you can let them get, I don't know if I got them rooted in enough to pull out, but you see how much bigger the plant is.
You ain't going out there. You won't.
Oh, I'm gonna try. This so much bigger. There we go. See there? Yeah.
Now
see?
You're gonna have a little more transplant shock with that
you
one.
You do. You do. But you grow a little bit bigger plant.
You got a little more time.
Yeah.
With that, excuse me, with that one right here. Whereas when these get ready like this, that's why I had to get mine in the ground earlier this week.
But yeah.
You can grow a lot more plants, a lot more space, but like I said, so everybody don't need this many plants.
My point is we got something for everybody regardless what size gardener you are.
So what I always tell people, if you got room for this kind of footprint, this kind of tray, what you do, you grow out a tray like this with maybe several different varieties of cabbage or broccoli or whatever. You plant what you need, you sell the rest for a couple dollars a plant, you pay for your seeds, and your seed starting trade.
Or if you got a big heart like me, you just give them away.
Well, that too. Sometimes we've talked about it before, sometimes you can sell them even and give them away.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought that was an interesting comparison there of the two ways you can grow these transplants out. A little bit for everybody. How about that?
How about that?
Lacinato kale and collards. Boy, ain't they pretty.
I got me some of that plant. If these folks out there that ain't planting collards, there's something wrong with them.
And look here, these right here in the greenhouse has not been sprayed the first time with an insecticide or a disease control. Now, they've been fertilized properly, but look at there. They're perfect.
Mm-hmm. Good-looking collards.
Yep.
I got me a whole row of them because I can eat a...
Ooh, I love them, too.
I can eat a passel of them. Pretty quick. And yeah, if you ain't never tried collards, if you don't like collards, it's probably because you ain't cooked them right. If you never tried growing them, you can grow them just about anywhere. They're really, really cold tolerant. You need to have some collards. And it's not because they're so cold tolerant, as long as you got a relatively room temp place to start your seeds, it's never too late to get some collards started.
Yeah, we've not used a heat pad on anything. So we've had sufficient temperature to get good germination on everything in the greenhouse.
What about you? You got an update on some onions, multiplying onions?
Yeah, if you follow our channel and keep up with our Robo Row show, you know I've been doing a lot of work with nesting onions and multiplying onions. Last year I had a decent little starter crop. This year I've got a lot planted. I got nine 100-foot rows planted right now.
You planting them by hand?
I did. And then probably by the weekend I have three or four more rows planted. So I staggered them a little bit just to see if there's going to be a difference. Planted them a couple of weeks apart.
You staggered them because that's all you felt like planting one day.
Well, that's another reason why. I'm telling you, I was woe out. My back hurt me.
You should have got your little PVC pipe.
No, I dibble-wheeled them. I laid them out there. I laid my rows out. I got me some chicken litter and put me some chicken litter, incorporated that in. Then I took my dibble wheel, which worked wonderful because I want to plant them further apart this year. Last year, I did notice I planted them too close together. Uh-huh. So this year, I planted them about 8 inches apart. My dibble wheel worked perfect for that. So I just run down through there and laid my space in that for me. And I just dropped them in there and come up. Of course, I had to bend that old back to get them down in there. Yeah. So it was a good Saturday. It wore me out. But I've got a few more to plant. But it looks like as of right now, it looks like it's going to be a great crop. We're going to have them offered to sell probably this fall.
Sell them in a little pack of, what, eight or so?
Whatever, yeah.
Speaking of dibble wheel, so in that no-till crop or plot I'm doing, I still had a good bit of pea debris below that thick layer of compost I added, so I couldn't go in there and make me a traditional furrow for planting without making a mess. So what I did is I took a single dibble wheel and run along where my rows were going to be. Now, if I had raked it and smoothed it and wet it a little bit, it would have punctured deep enough to put this in, but I had to move a little soil out of the way. But it worked perfect for that. For those of you that are doing like no-till with compost, market farm, and stuff like that, that thing works like a charm for marking off spot for transplants.
These pea vines can be a little aggravating to get rid of. If you put your tiller in there too soon, they'll get wrapped up on that.
I just covered mine up and they just breaking down.
Yeah, I probably should have done
let
that.
Let nature do their thing.
Yeah.
What else we got going on? Soon, next day or two, I'm starting to get some onions in the ground. I know it ain't November yet, but last year I planted some in October, and I did just fine. These here, and I showed you them plethora of onions. We showed them last week, and those are going to be the first to get in. These right here are going to be right behind them. So I planted these, I think, a week or so behind the plethora. I kind of staggered my planting, so I had to plant them all at one time. This is a variety called Cougar. And like Jason said, he said, you got to be careful putting these onions right here around young men. And cougars get them. But anyway, this is an old tray we had.
This is a thick one right here.
This is 392.
Yeah, I'd say that's about right.
Anyway, I don't like it quite as much as that deep 338 we sell, but it's a similar concept. Anyway, we can see right there, them puppies are ready to go in the ground.
Yeah, I will tell you this. the onions do so much better than the 338 trays than they do the 162s. Now, if all you got is a 162, by all means use it, but they grow out a lot better, I've noticed, in the 338s.
Yeah, I would say if you're doing them in a 162 just for space reasons, unless you just don't need that many onions. If I was doing them in 162, I'd put several seeds per cell and then pull them apart. Yeah, just to get more of my space. Yeah. I mean, there's a heap of onion plants in here.
They are.
More than I'm going to need to plant. But sometimes you just like to grow a whole tray. Everybody I've talked to said with these cougars, they've been getting awesome, awesome germination. It's a round, big round onion. So speaking of onions, and I don't remember if we covered this when we talked about onions, but right when we put these in the ground, almost just as soon as we put them in there, because now, bought onions is a little different because you got to wait on them to start growing, but these you don't. As soon as we put them in the ground, I'm going to start shooting some 20-20-20 to them. Just as soon as I put them in the ground. I'm changing my strategy this year with anything I'm transplanting. I'm not waiting on it to start growing. I'm going to hit them as soon as I put them in the ground. And then I'd say about 4 weeks after, about a month after they're in the ground, that's when I'm going to switch over and just go with some ammonium sulfate on them.
I'm going to rotate a little bit more than that, but I'm going to use it about every other time, ammonium sulfate, then go back 20-20-20.
Oh, yeah? See, I go straight nitrogen after about the first.
It's according to what your phosphorus load is in your soil.
Yeah.
Is whether I would do that or not.
Mine's pretty good. That compost I got is pretty.
If you have a high phosphorus load, I think you could get by with it. If not, I think you still need to rotate some in there.
Anyway, onion timing this year has been real good. I'd say better than it was last year as far as having plants ready. And
you can definitely grow these things off quicker than any 6 weeks. You can grow them off in 4 weeks if you really pump it to them.
Yeah, and there's still plenty of time. I mean, even down here, we have planted onions as late November, early mid-December before. So
yeah.
If you're still on the fence about growing your own onion plants, so you want to try some of these varieties that you can't get anywhere else, still got plenty of time to make this right here happen. They are slower to germinate. They will take a little more patience. I've talked to a few customers who have had some patience issues.
Mm-hmm.
These things take a little longer to germinate and get going as opposed to a collard or broccoli. Something like that. But once they get going like this, better watch out.
And they just fun to grow.
They fun to grow and look pretty in a tray like that.
You know, we've got a couple of new things we've been working on in the last few weeks. And I'm really excited about these products because I'm going to need some of them pretty soon.
That's right.
I've got a new little fig orchard I have put in, and I've been having to water with a little water hose.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have
that get old.
It gets old. And we have come up with two new irrigation kits. One of them is a fruit tree kit, and another one is container irrigation kits.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are going to be wonderful for people that's got small orchards or that like to garden in containers but want to put an irrigation system on there.
Yeah, and I thought about doing today's show on these kits, but I wasn't 100% sure with the new website how it was going to go. I didn't want to promise them being there and not being there. They will likely be on the site by the time this show airs, but next week we'll do a whole show on them, kind of give you a breakdown of all the pieces and components. It's really, really simple. A lot of the same pieces that are in our normal drip tape kit. Except this, you're not using tape, you're using mainline, and you hook these little emitters in it. We even got these little fancy flush valves to go on the end of your mainline to keep them from getting any algal buildup or freezing if you live somewhere cold. You got a little different hole punch. Got this little guy right here, punches a hole with the emitters. We'll go over all this next week. We should have these on the site, like I said, as of the airing of this show. We'll have two different kits. The kits are going to be pretty much the same components, just different quantities. So the container kit, you get more, I think, emitters than the fruit tree kit.
Yeah, but if you've got a small orchard and you've been really struggling, I mean, this is going to be the answer to you. Or if you got a bunch of those 5-gallon buckets or grow pots or nursery containers that you grow in, and you're worried about it takes you so long when you come in the afternoon because you have to hand water, this is the ticket right here.
Yeah, that has become increasingly more popular over the years. People that have, I know Deep South, I don't know if they still do with their greenhouse, but they used to have just a row of these two. They look like 5-10 gallon containers, a long row of two of them. And they, you need a good way to water them.
Yeah, the biggest drawback with these container garden is watering, because they seem to dry, it's just a lot with raised beds. They seem to dry out a lot quicker than in-ground plants do. They grow off a little sooner because they have more heat because they're out in the ground. Weeds are a little easier to control, but water's always been an issue there. So this right here situation will help that a lot.
So y'all be on the lookout for that, and we'll try to cover that next week. This week, I decided to do an all Q&A show because we got some good questions here, and some that might take a little time. I might have a filibuster on a few of them. And so I think we got 8 questions here we're going to bust through. And a lot of stuff about onions, a lot of good questions here. And I didn't want to just answer a few of these, so I decided we'd not have a main segment and just go through some of these good questions from last week's show.
First one's from John Mendez, and it says, question to the show regarding onions. If I'm growing onions in the designated intermediate area of the country, but the plot on my property is located down deep in the holler.
In the holler.
The holler, that means way down in the bottom, mm-hmm. where the sun don't come across the mountain until 8 or 9 a.m., such as the mountain area of Appalachia. Anyway, then should I be using short day onions? What you say, Travis? Should you be short day onions? Because this daylight is going to be cut back.
Well, you know, Randy Travis, his love was deeper than the holler.
Yeah. Man, he's making me talk about deep in the holler, and the sun will come up at 8 or 9 a.m. He's getting me mountain fever.
All right, so let's back up here. So short day onions are going to, bulbing is going to be triggered when day length reaches between 10 to 12 hours. Intermediate day onions, your day length is going to be triggered at 12 to 14 hours. Now, if he is indeed deep in the holler and his daylight is delayed, one thing he's going to want to be careful with, he might not ever get to 12 to 14 hours of daylight if that holler stays dark in the morning time like he's suggesting. So that's one thing I was, if you're not going to get to that 12 to 14 hours of daylight, what you're going to end up doing is growing onions with just a bunch of top, because you're never going to get that day length triggered, the bulbing triggered by that certain amount of day length. So if that is the case, yeah, I think you could certainly grow short day onions, and you would want to trigger that bulbing at 10 to 12 hours. The one thing to consider there, if you are going to grow short day onions, John, is getting them in the ground soon enough so you can get enough vegetation on them when you do hit to that 10 to 12 hours.
That's a very unique problem he's got there.
Yeah, that's what happens deeper than the holler.
Deep in the holler.
All right, number 2 is from David H. And he says, how are you onions doing you started in the raised bed compared to the ones in the tray? Now, we had talked about this. We were doing a little experiment, and you were growing some in the raised bed, and I've been bragging on my tray onions. So what's your verdict there?
Well, my little raised bed there that I planted was a 4x4, and they've grown up okay there. The problem's been the weeds. You just can't control the weeds in there as easy as you can.
It takes long to germinate.
It takes a little longer to germinate. The trays are such more of a controlled environment. It's just easier to grow them off in. If you have the ability to grow them in trays, I say that's the way to go. If not, second best thing is raised bed. But I definitely would give the trays my first choice.
If you're going to really grow them in a bed, and not a lot of people are going to want to do this, but the way the big boys, they use pre-emergent herbicides, you about have to, don't you?
It's tough. It's tough.
So, yeah. I didn't know if you hadn't talked about it because you forgot about it, or you just kind of realized you've been spanked.
I may be padded a little bit. But the trays are a lot better.
And you, for most folks, you can grow plenty of onion plants in one end.
Yeah, you know, I tell you what I would do. This right here, fill your pot and soil up about half of that.
And would you drill some holes in there? No?
Yeah, I would drill some holes in there. Maybe next year we'll have some holes in them. I would drill some holes in them.
Yeah, I've seen people do that. Just take that and just sprinkle them everywhere.
Yeah, I think you could probably easily get 100 plants in there.
Keep them in a controlled environment. Mm-hmm. The trick is, see, that seed start mix is sterile. Any garden soil, whatever's going to have weed seeds in it, even just a few is going to cause you problems.
Yeah.
You really need to be planting them in a sterile mix there.
Yeah, that would be my second choice.
You could probably do it. Now, if somebody had a little container or a pot, you could do them in there.
Sure, you could. Sure, you can do it in a raised bed. I'm just telling you, we've done better with them in trays because everything's controlled better. The moisture's controlled in there better. The fertility, we control that. We just have everything there when it needs it. We're in a raised bed. If it rains or whatever, you may let some things go lacking in that tray there. We go to the greenhouse every day and we, just like when we're growing our brassicas, we baby them. We put everything, when they need it, it's there.
Give them that love.
Yep. All right, the next one is from Don't Piddle My Life.
Man, that's pity.
Don't piddle, I got my glasses
piddle, on. That's what you've been doing.
Piddle, yeah. Don't pity my life. Would love to know if you have any tips on growing leeks. I've been reviewing a lot of your past shows, but mostly just hear you talking about they're easy to grow. Sadly for me, that has not been the case. I am in Zone B, Southern California coast, and I've never gotten them fatter than a pencil. But further up north in California, they grow amazing leeks. Not sure if it's a zone issue or what.
No, I don't know. I've never tried growing leeks that far south, but I don't see why it would be an issue. I got some leeks I planted just for a week or two ago. They just starting to come up. And leeks, to me, I treat them exactly like I do onions, initially at least. They're going to look a lot like these onion transplants I showed you earlier. When I put them in the ground, I want to plant them. Them onions, I don't plant deep at all. Just cover up the little white part. Now, leeks, you don't plant them deep. I like using a broad fork. You can use whatever you want to. We want to plant them deep. And then they just like onions, really, as far as their fertilization and their feeding. They're going to like plenty of water. You're going to need to give them a good, complete fertilizer initially, and then just kind of pump the nitrogen to them. And then if you want the nice, big, long, white, edible part on there, throw a little more dirt to them as they grow. It's just you got to realize they're heavy feeders like onions. That's important. And then planting them deep is going to be important as well.
I grew leeks for the first time last year. I had decent luck with them.
Yeah. Yeah. The healing is the key part there, and getting them planted deep. That's if you want the nice big ones, that's the way to do it.
I got to do some more work on cooking them. I'm not a real good.
We made some leek and tater soup last year. Yeah. That was absolutely off the chain. Number four is from Frank Bernard. He says, what are your thoughts about using a pre-emergent such as Prowl? I ain't heard of Prowl in a long time. For weed control in the market garden.
Yeah, I don't think there's a problem with it if you want to go down that road. Prowl, the active ingredient in Prowl is pendimethalin, which is the old yellow herbicide. It's been around for a long time. I don't think Prowl is available to the home gardener at your big box stores, but you can buy it at your farm supply place. It's pretty readily available there. It's used a lot in commercial vegetable production. It's used a lot in the lawn care industry. It's used a lot in row crops. Works pretty good. You can, matter of fact, it's labeled. You can do your onion transplants. Now, you need to water them in first because you need to firm up that dirt around them. But you can spray Prowl on the top of your onions after you transplant them. Oh. Then you'll need to water it in again to activate it. Prowl's a pretty decent pre-emergent herbicide. Now, when we talk about pre-emergent herbicide, I'm just going to throw a little bonus out there for you, okay? Uh-huh. Are you ready for this?
Go ahead.
Most people think this Prowl pre-emergent herbicide keeps that weed seed from germinating. That actually is not true. What happens when that weed seed sprouts and it puts that white tender root, the very first one that shoots out of there hunting some good fertile ground to peg down in, and it runs out there and it hits that chemical, Prowl, and it dies back. And that's what causes that plant to die. But it doesn't keep the seed from germinating. The seed actually germinates and then shoots that tender root out there, and that's when it zaps it.
So why does it not inhibit the onion root growth?
You know, that's the class of chemistry sometimes, whether it be dicots or monocots, sometimes has an issue on that. But I have never found anybody that can answer that question for me. And believe you me, I've asked it a lot of times.
Yeah.
Triflan is used extensively in vegetable production. And you incorporate triflan or water it into your soils in your plant, And why does it not let one and but let the other one go? I don't know. If anybody knows out there, let us know, because I would.
Sure, somebody.
I've been asking that question for years and years and years. Now, on some of your post-emergence, I understand that. We're talking about strictly pre-emergence. What's the selectivity on some of your pre-emergence here? Besides the monocot, dicot, I understand that with atrazine, but on the prowls and the treflans and stuff like that, I don't understand that.
Yeah. I don't know. I like to understand it as well. Not that I'm going to ever use any of those, but it's just interesting.
And next question comes from Kobe Stowers. And he says, excellent show as always. Thank you. Have either of you watched Kiss the Ground on NextFlim? I thought it was an interesting documentary, but I would have liked to see more insight from farmers doing the no-till thing. I'd be interested to hear what you think about what you two think about it. NextFlim, what is NextFlim?
NextFlim is obviously something you don't have. You don't watch.
I hadn't heard of this Kiss the Ground on NextFlim.
With all the youngsters, that's the phrase. Is instead of going on a date, they Netflix and chill. That means they go over to
How do I get NextFlim?
Netflix, it's just you just pay for it. Monthly subscription. Or you find somebody that's got one, unless you borrow
the I may budget. Just have to go over to somebody's house and watch this.
Yeah, you might have to. Anyway, we had quite a few people talk about this Kiss the Ground documentary on Netflix last week, and I wanted to do my homework before I answered this question. And so I watched it last night, and it was really, really good. Thought it was good. Woody Harrelson was narrating it. And there was nothing on there that just jumped out at me as contentious or things that I would just blatantly disagree with. But I did write down a few points here that I have on it, and I'll try to go through these. So the first one, and this is just in general. So a little background, when I was at the University of Georgia, some of the graduate work I did was on carbon, global carbon cycling, and we were studying in particular the stuff called marine snow.
Here we go again.
So you got in the deep ocean, you got these aggregates of plankton and fecal pellets and all this stuff, and when they get so big, they sink and they fall down to the ocean floor. And that's how a lot of your carbon gets from the atmosphere. The ocean absorbs a lot of it, and that carbon sinks down there. And it's all a big part of this global carbon cycle, which is important because that's what they're talking about on this documentary. Anyway, I said that to say this. When I was up there, I worked with a lot of climate scientists because the model we were using had to use a lot of what they call global circulation models, which is used for these climate predictions. All this climate science stuff. So I worked with a lot of professors who use these models, study these kind of things. And what I understood after that experience is that some of this science, it's not bad science, but it can be skewed a little bit. Because what you have here,
amen,
is you have the people who are funding this research on the left side of the political fence.
Or the right side.
Well, in this case, it's the climate research. The people that are funding this particular research, like what I was doing, are on the left side of the fence. So then all your professors are mostly liberal. It would behoove them to produce results that agreed with the political beliefs of the people who were funding the research. Not saying it's bad science, I'm just saying you have to kind of understand that when you're looking at any of this climate research. Now, you see the same thing happening on the right side of the political fence. You see companies like Monsanto and other large companies funding research to say that their practices aren't that bad, and that research usually comes back and confirms what they're trying to preach. So you see it all the time, both ways. Both sides of the aisle are to blame for skewing research a little bit here and there.
Yeah, especially with the land grant universities, but all your research is funded. And those funding comes from a think tank, a nonprofit that has an agenda, or a public company. It can come from anywhere. But they've always wanted a particular end result.
The funding is not apolitical. It's always politically driven.
Usually. Yeah, but they always want a particular outcome from the research. The people that fund it When they do that, they don't do it with an open mind. Okay, well, what if so-and-so has, that's not the way it happens. They want a particular outcome. So they structure it so that they get that particular outcome. So any kind of research that you see comes out, take it with a grain of salt.
I wouldn't say take it with a grain of salt. Just
I do. I don't put a lot of faith in a lot of those research.
I would say take it with a grain of salt. I would just understand that some of the predictions, some of the prognoses that are derived from the research can tend to be a little bit extreme. That's what I would say. Anyway, so in this particular documentary, I didn't see any super or what I thought were outlandish takes or statements as far as climate change or anything, the environment like that. I thought everything was I wouldn't say exactly on point, but nothing jumped out at me as like, this is absolutely ridiculous. Now, so the whole point of this documentary, what they're trying to say is that we've got all this excess carbon in the atmosphere, right? Now, yes, we need to find ways to reduce our putting more carbon in the atmosphere, but what do we do about that that's already there? And what these scientists have come up with is that if we can increase or increase our soil structure,
or soil biology.
The soil biology, the way we do agriculture in this country, then that will absorb a significant portion of that carbon and actually get us into more of a, well, they call it a global cooling pattern instead of a global warming pattern. Okay, so then they go into the issues with today's modern agriculture and talk about how it has created this process called desertification, where you just basically have all this lifeless land out there that is being farmed. The majority of it is being farmed to feed livestock. There's a guy on there, I think it was in North Dakota, he was a traditional commercial farmer, and then a few hailstorms and a drought just made him joke broke. And he had to change the way he farmed just because he had no other choice. So he goes into a thing, and I think he's on point with this, and he talks about how, you know, subsidized farming is basically corporate welfare, and that it is destroying that whole structure of subsidizing large-scale farming is kind of destroying our land.
Not on that, but it's not sustainable because it derives or depends on a income stream from the government.
Right. So the video is basically say, or the documentary is saying that if we could transition the way we do farming, large-scale agriculture, to more no-till techniques, we could sequester a lot more carbon from the atmosphere. We'd have healthier soils, just a healthier globe in general. Now, there are a lot of farmers that around here, a vast majority of them, that do no-till. But they don't do no-till in the sense to build soils. They do no-till because it's the cheapest way for them to farm.
Cha-ching.
And because they found that it's a good way to keep pigweeds from going crazy on you.
Less trips across the field, less diesel to be burnt. They use the Roundup because it's cheaper and, I mean, it's just easier for them to do. A lot of them call it chemical farming.
Now, some of them do cover crop, but from what I understand, most of that cover cropping is subsidized as well.
Yeah.
So that they only do it when they're paid to do it, which is, you know, you would like for them to do it because they want to build the soil.
So that's a good point what you bring up there, and I agree with it totally. The problem is, economically, how do you make it happen? That's where the whole problem comes in at. How do you make that happen on a scale that is beneficial for the farmer?
Well, you know, and a lot of the bad practices out there, which result in bad education, a lot of these farmers, as they demonstrate in this video, a lot of the commercial farmers nowadays, they don't understand soil building. They just understand a certain narrow way they were taught to do something growing up, to grow cotton or peanuts.
Well, but also you got to look at it from this standpoint. So a lot of these farmers nowadays may not own the land. They may be renting the land. They don't know if they're going to be there another year, another 5 years, what. So they take it on a year-by-year basis.
Milking it.
And it's a profit thing. I'm not blaming them, but it's just the way it is. So they're looking at it from a profit loss statute of 1 year. They're not going to do anything to build that soil because they may not have it next year or the year after.
And it's not their soil.
Right.
So it's hard to get them to make an investment in it when they don't know what their terms are going to be, and the whole system is set up for them not to care about the soil. Other things that I thought about, you know, with these cover crops, if you do start doing some intensive cover cropping, doing no-till planting into them, which you can do, how do you terminate that cover crop? You know, that's going to be more costly for the farmer. They use Roundup around here because it's cheap. If you start going in there to crimp it or roll it or mow it, that is going to drive up the cost for the farmer, which is going to eventually drive up the food cost. And if we were all to commit to this style of farming on a large scale, we would likely see food prices increase. Now, some people might be okay with that. There may be other people who are struggling to get by, which might have a hard time with that.
Some of your hardcore activists out there say that our food is too cheap anyway. May have a point.
It could be. But that could cause
an imbalance.
Create some disturbance and whatever.
So it's a complex issue that there's no easy answer to, but I think it's worthy of discussion. I think it's worthy for us to work on.
I agree. And I like I said, I enjoyed the documentary. I didn't think it was real far left. Obviously, it wasn't super far right. But I thought it was really interesting to watch, a good watch. You got an hour and a half, you got Netflix, sit down and watch. It's called Kiss the Gram, and there's a lot to learn there. And like I said, it wasn't trying to push you in one direction or the next necessarily, just trying to educate you on what we can do as a group effort just to make things better.
Kiss the Gram on Netflix. If you watched it, let us know your thoughts.
My Netflix,
I'm going to have to find somebody. One of my neighbors got some Netflix so I can watch it, because it sounds like somebody enjoy watching.
All right.
So what I do, just ask them. I know knock on the door, I said, you got Netflix?
Yeah. What's your Netflix login? You need to log in.
Oh, if I got login, I can watch it at my house.
You got login, you can create your own little profile there. And you can steal it forever.
Netflix login.
That's what you need.
Okay. That's what I like.
Yeah, you do have a smart TV. I do know that. So you can get on it and you can do that. You watch YouTube on?
Not on my TV. I personally can't get it on there. Some of my family members can get it up there and I can watch on there, but I can't by myself get YouTube on my smart
TV. Technically challenged. Okay. All right.
However, I can grow a good onion, a good tater, and good tomato. I can do all that. A lot of my tech smart friends and family can't do that. So we all got our battles we have to.
I got you. All right. Speaking of onions, number 6, Carol Perry says, what are your thoughts on adding humic acid powder in the soil when growing onions and garlic?
I think it's great, Carol. I think you forgot it. I think put it out there. It's not going to hurt anything. The problem with it is you're not able to order this stuff. And most of the time, what I've seen on the internet, you order it in pounds or a pint or 5 pounds at the most. You're not going to be able to get enough of it to make a huge difference unless you're doing just a little bitty area. If you got a 4x4 raised bed, yeah, it could make some difference in that. But if you're doing a 25-foot row, it's not going to be feasible to put it out there in the quantities that's going to make a difference. It would take a lot of it. What I like better is some good quality compost, because good quality compost has humic acid, fulvic acid, and worlds of other beneficial fungus and beneficial activity in that that's going to help. So that would be my go-to, would get some good compost, put it out there, heck, maybe 2 tons to the acre. You can break that down. It's hard to overdo it with good compost. Put it out there, and that'll do wonders for you.
I've been known to put 3 tons per 1,000 square feet.
Yeah, you go a little low. But you don't burn with it.
No, we don't burn.
You better get out of the way, hadn't
they? When I get to spreading it, you better get out of the way. They actually mentioned that in the documentary, talking about compost and humus and stuff like that, and how that was another part of the equation.
Next question from Jesse Dutton. I live in zone 7A. I have my Savannah sweet onion seeds in my plug tray and covered with perlite like y'all said to do. Do I need to put a light on them or heat mat, or do I just leave them in an unheated greenhouse?
So I'm gonna bring these puppies back out here as I talk about them. So, I have got some, I think 8 trays of onions in the greenhouse, and I'll be starting to get some of these in the ground soon. I got the plethora we started on the tray on the show. A week or so after that, I got a tray of cougar started. That's what this is. And then after that, or that same day, I did a tray of Carta Blanca white onions. Then a few days later, a week later, I did some Duster. And then a few days to a week later after that, I got some Savannah Sweet, some Sweet Ages. Anyway, I got about 8 different varieties, and I started them all at different times. And so our greenhouse, we have the sides rolled up. So if we do get a cool spell, it can get equally cool in there. And what I'm saying here is I didn't pay any attention to what outside temperature was, and it's been fairly rangy here the last month.
Rangy.
And so I have started my onions in a wide range of temperatures, I feel like, within a 20-degree range, and haven't seen any differences in germination. Now, I don't know what the ideal germ temperature for onions is, but the range seems to be pretty wide, and we haven't, as you can see, had any germination issues so far. So I would say no heat mat. Even in zone 7, you wouldn't need a heat mat. I think you're fine growing them in your greenhouse. Most greenhouses around here are a lot warmer than ours because, like I said, we leave the sides rolled up. So, yeah, it shouldn't be no problem.
The only thing I would mention is if you do have a hot day, keep an eye on the cells. They dry out pretty quick on them hot days. You want to make sure they got plenty of moisture in there.
It's in these 338. So, yeah. Ain't a whole lot of soil there compared to the plant. Your plant-to-soil ratio is a little different. And they're going to need water 2 or 3 times a day. Last one is from Nelson Cobbs. I don't want to say Nelson Knobs. Nelson Cobbs. So how long does it take for English peas to germinate? He's in zone 8 in Texas. What should be the soil temp for germination?
I planted some probably about 10 days ago, and mine came up in 7-10 days, which is normal. What they'll come up in good soil conditions, good soil moisture, and good soil temperature. Somewhere in the range of 60-70 degrees is ideal. Plenty of moisture, should pop them out of the ground in 7-10 days easy. As always, plant them English peas thick. They are a little bit slower to come up than your regular peas. In the fall of the year, you want to get them up before that cold weather rolls in here. I like to get mine about this tall before that frost hits them. That way they can withstand it. When they're small, man, they just don't do good with a hard freeze. They'll get stunted. So plant them, get them up like this right here before the cold weather gets in there, and you'll be fine. To answer your question, 7-10 days.
Yeah, English peas like that in-between weather, like I like to say. I got some about this tall. They're mighty slow to grow in the beginning. Once they get going, they'll get going good. They are slow to get going and test my patience sometimes.
But well worth it when you start eating them.
When you start harvesting them. Did you plant the Sugar Prince?
I did. Now, tell you the reason I planted that Sugar Prince is so I can gather the early ones as sugar snaps.
What we call snow peas.
Put them in my salad, or you can let them mature out and have the regular English peas. I thought that was a great variety that you could do both of with.
That's one of my favorite things to put up is English peas.
Yep.
You can't have enough of them in the freezer. Because when it gets hot, we can't grow them.
If there's one crop out there that there's a major difference in buying them in the store and growing them out in your garden, it's English peas. Totally different taste. So much better out of the garden. I really don't care for them out of can. But I love them out of the garden. Eat them raw, heck.
Yeah, Tata, he'll sit there and eat a passel of them.
Yep.
All right. Hope everybody enjoyed that kind of extended Q&A segment. And if you have any other questions or comments on any of our responses to these questions, we'd love to hear about it. Go check out that documentary if you can, and let us know what you think about it. Try to keep it clean. You know, we don't want any political divisiveness in our comment section, but keep it informed, keep it educational, because that's what we're here for, is just to help people grow their own food.
Heck yeah.
And, you know, try to take care of one another. So, hope everybody enjoyed the show. And if you did, give us a big thumbs up. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Ring that bell so you get notified every time we come out with a new video. We'll see you next time.
Take care.